What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
I'm Adam Campanar. And you say you love me.
I don't love you, man. I never did. None of us love you.
You act above us, you always have.
Finally, the truth.
You just held it over us like you might leave. Like we're lucky to be with you. And we had to live with it, man. I had to live with you, and now I might die with you, and it's not fair.
Please, enough!
Man, nothing's been the same since that trip home after episode 500, has it, Josh?
Well, that leap you took off the music box marquee, that was a little much.
Well, gotta do what you gotta do.
This week on the show, we get to feel almost famous going on tour with our top five movie bands, plus a review of Frank starring Michael Fassbender and his papier-mâché head. That and more.
I'm on drugs!
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store.
For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM. That's squarespace.com and offer code FILM. You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Campanar. And to think, Josh, we almost called the show Adam Campanar and Sexual Chocolate.
I'm pretty sure I never would have listened to that.
It's got a nice ring to it. Come on. Later in the show, a cast of little people will crush our miniature Stonehenge set beneath their feet. That and more Spinal Tap references when we share our top five movie bands. Plus, Josh's take on Sin City, A Dame to Kill For.
But first, our discussion of Frank, starring Michael Fassbender as the oddball leader of an underground experimental rock band that achieves sudden notoriety. For our review, Adam, can you please take off that papier-mâché head of Michael Phillips you're wearing? It's very distracting.
I say tell everyone everything. Why cover anything up? Right?
How to describe Frank?
1, 2, 3, 4!
Well, there's the head, of course.
He never takes it off. You think it's weird? Would it help if I said my facial expressions out loud? Welcoming smile.
Delighted look.
But what goes on inside the head inside that head?
I find this inspiring.
Is music.
Showing his pussies up at his!
Frank, people should know about you. You should be famous.
Flattered grin, followed by a bashful half-smile.
Stop saying your facial expressions out loud. It's extremely annoying.
Maybe it's because we discussed Dead Poets Society here on the show last week, but I've had this poem swirling around in my head as I've been preparing for this discussion. A poem, it so happens, that really grabbed me when I was the same age as the boys at Welton Academy. T.S. Eliot's The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. And indeed there will be time for the yellow smoke that slides along the street, rubbing its back upon the window panes. There will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create. To prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. Eliot suggesting there that we all go through life putting on masks. That's the obvious connection to Frank, a movie featuring a mysterious avant-garde singer who never takes off his giant papier-mâché head, though a strong case could be made that the succeeding line is even more appropriate. There will be time to murder and create. While there are no homicides in Frank, there is death and enough despair and destruction that it seems inextricably linked to the act of creation. Written by John Ronson and Peter Strawn, Frank is loosely based on Ronson's own experiences in the 80s as a 20-year-old London keyboardist plucked to play in a band led by the enigmatic Frank Sidebottom, who, yes, wore a giant head, though maybe not quite as obsessively as his on-screen counterpart. In a recent Guardian article recounting some of his memories from his time in Frank's band, Ronson cites a soon-to-be-published biography by another writer that, quote, captures perfectly that rarest of journeys when an onlooker got to see the man born Chris Seavey turn into Frank. The moment the head is placed, the change occurs. Not merely a change in attitude or outlook, but a journey from one person to the other. I completely believe that Chris was born as two people. Josh, there's only one person wearing the head in Frank, though he's usually so good and so formidable a presence on screen that he might as well be two people. He is Michael Fassbender, who has donned a mask of sorts a few times as Magneto in the X-Men movies, but never until now has his face, usually a pretty important tool for an actor, been completely concealed. does Fassbender still manage to take you on that rare journey into the head of Frank Sidebottom? And whose journey did you ultimately find more interesting, Frank's or that of Ronson's surrogate, John, played by Donald Gleason, a young man so desperately in need of an identity that he searches for it by trying to make sense of the man behind those big, unblinking papier-mâché eyes?
Well, first of all, I love it when you recite poetry to me. If you could work that into all of your introductions, I'd really appreciate it.
It's becoming a thing here on the show, so I may work it into every show.
I'm getting spoiled. So it's not a fair question because, first of all, it's Fassbender compared to Gleason, and Fassbender, even wearing this mask of sorts, has the sort of charisma that you associate with
him. Gleason's a good actor, though.
Gleason's a very good actor, yeah. We both have appreciated his work and some other stuff recently, but, you know, Fassbender, we'll get to his performance overall, but let's just say he brings a lot to the role, even though he has to give up some of his crucial tools.
Mm-hmm.
He's still able to do a lot with the role. And the other reason it's not quite fair is because your sympathy lies more with the Frank character. At least mine did. I mean, John is this not very talented keyboardist, we're led to believe, who doesn't intentionally glom on and become a parasite to this band, but it eventually becomes that sort of relationship for him as the movie goes on. And we don't really have any reason to root for him, basically. And
okay. You
do. And I would say that you get more and more reasons to maybe not root for, but to become attached to the Frank character as we learn more about him.
Mm-hmm.
As the movie really opens up and becomes more rich and we start to understand what it's about and what it's exploring and who Frank is and how he represents some of those crucial questions to the film.
Mm-hmm.
This is a movie that I enjoyed quite a bit for the majority of its running time. But once the mask does come off, and it's not just because we see Fassbender's face, but because there are other revelations that come along with it, that this movie really hit another level for me. And that final scene, which we should get to, just sent into the stratosphere. That left me just, you know, feeling like this movie had been doing things I wasn't even aware of until that final scene.
Well, to make sure we're on the same page, there's a song being performed. Is that
that's the one
moved
yeah.
you so much? You're right. That's a fantastic ending, and it really doesn't have so much to do with the revelation at all of seeing his face, though we have caught it earlier. It's more the revelation in the emotion of the moment, the poignancy of the moment, and the song, and the way there actually develops a sort of communal feeling, whereas it's all been really tied in to the individual before that. I'm with you, obviously. Fassbender, a little bit on a higher stratosphere than Donald Gleason at this point, though, as I said, he's a very good actor. And Frank is definitely, overall, the more interesting character. But maybe you're just more confident with yourself than I am, and you're not quite the former aspiring artist that I am, because I certainly felt a lot of sympathy for the Donald Gleason character, who, as we said, is called John, because more than anything, even though it doesn't explicitly get into this by the end of the film, it does make it clear, nevertheless, that in some ways it's the coming of age of a writer. It's someone discovering that he's not really a musician. He's probably not even an artist. And maybe I am reading into this that I know a little bit about John Ronson, who this is based on. He is basing this on his own life, but he became a journalist. He's someone who's very good at articulating other people's stories and expressing them well, but maybe not so much expressing what's actually going on inside of him. And I feel that. I understand that kind of anguish of that, I guess. And so I was rooting for him throughout this whole film.
So you've been posting videos of us online.
That's not the point. Because of those clips, we've been offered a really important gig.
You've been spying on us.
South by Southwest. In Texas. It's very prestigious. They've got a new discovery strand.
That's ridiculous. Come on, Frank, let's get you cleaned up.
Why does it say 23751 at the bottom?
That's the number of people who've watched the clip.
23751 people are interested in us?
Come on, Frank.
It's like magic.
I told you we could be big.
Well, here's what it is. His journey is a trajectory of someone finding out what they're not.
Right.
And there's something maybe true to that, but also a little bit deflating as a narrative, where we like to follow along with the person, the main figure, who makes a discovery and pursues and attains something.
Mm-hmm.
This is really, you're following the John character who thinks he knows what he wants to do,
right,
and is good at it. And by the end of the film realizes, no, this is not my place. And
yeah,
I think that's a true journey. And that's one of the reasons I liked that this ending has a little bittersweetness despite the uplift.
Sure.
That plays in with the John character, whereas Frank's trajectory is one of finding exactly where he should be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily where a traditional movie narrative about a striving rock band ends up, but it feels like it's the exact right place.
Well, I mentioned Dead Poets Society, and we did do our top five Robin Williams scenes last week. We paid tribute to that actor. And I don't know if you had a similar experience or not with this movie, but I watched this right on the heels of all that Robin Williams prep. And it was really quite eerie for me watching this movie in the wake of Williams' suicide and our discussion of his work, because I think among the many things this movie is fundamentally about, and there are a lot of areas this movie touches on, I don't think you can ignore its depiction of mental illness and its influence, positive and negative, on the creative impulse and creative output. Frank here is not just an artist with an affectation or this professional gimmick. He's legitimately disturbed. And what you see in Donald Gleason's character is this aspiring artist who has talent, but probably not quite enough talent, not as much talent as Frank has, or maybe just doesn't have the right temperament to be successful, to be the artist he aspires to be. So what does he do? He does what most of us do when we feel insufficient. We rationalize. We look for an explanation. And his explanation is, well, I'm just not crazy enough. I don't have what Frank has. The same way saxophone players famously thought they had to do heroin and thought they had to suffer to play like Charlie Parker. He latches on to Frank, hoping that the secret will somehow reveal itself to him, or that maybe he'll just go mad himself and then he'll come out the other side and be a quote unquote true artist. And it made me think of a tweet I saw in the day or so after Robin Williams' death, where someone said, and I really wish I could remember the exact quote and context, but they said something along the lines of, getting treatment doesn't stifle creativity. It actually helps it. It encourages even more creativity. And I don't know if that's true, Josh. Ultimately, I'd certainly like to believe it's true, but I do think the worst thing a movie can do is glamorize or romanticize the madness. And we see here in this movie the consequences for the John character and for Frank when that happens.
The movie itself undercuts that whole notion.
It does.
I think one of the central questions is asking is, how is creativity born? And one thing that it wonders maybe is madness, though I'd argue that the mental illness factor doesn't really come to the fore till the latter half of the film.
It doesn't.
But early on, what they do,
you can
think,
read into it, though.
You can read into it. Well, sure, because you're wondering, why is this guy walking around with a, how seriously is he taking it?
Yeah, he goes beyond just,
right,
I'm wearing this, like maybe it sounds like the real Frank Sidebottom did, where sometimes it affected his offstage life, but in this movie, it really is constant.
So there is that thread there. But I think the question at the beginning that John asks is, have I suffered enough to be an artist? And
right,
that's where this myth of Frank builds up, that he grew up in Kansas, mm-hmm, supposedly. And I don't think anyone, including Frank, ever tells John about his childhood in Kansas. They just assume it was a horrible childhood because of that misunderstanding that you have to suffer in order to produce art.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie goes on to undercut it when John eventually finds Frank's childhood home, and it turns out to be Anytown, USA, clean, nicely mowed lawn suburbia. And, you know, John makes the comment, we see his parents early on in the film, nice, tidy little home. And he says, it looked like my house.
Uh-huh.
So why is Frank a genius? And why am I not a genius? And there's also the part where they go off to record this album. They're in a cabin, isolated. And it's this trial by fire for John because he's the new member in the band and the others don't take to him. And finally, he says at one point, this is my abusive childhood, something like that. You know, this is my suffering. Now I will become an artist.
Yeah.
And does he? Not really.
No, he really doesn't. I'm really glad you touched on the upbringing aspect. And we are kind of getting ahead of things a little bit, but I don't think we're spoiling anything when we point out that there is a time later in the film where he gets a glimpse of Frank's upbringing. And the movie doesn't just suggest that we're supposed to read something into this symmetry. There's direct symmetry. The beginning of the film, I really like how it sets up everything we need to know about what kind of artist John is,
mm-hmm,
how it is so meticulous, and it shows him trying to integrate real life into his art, and he's just full of song ideas. And then, of course, by the time it gets down to him really needing to sit down and and come up with something and create something, all he can do is end up tweeting something about what he's having for dinner, you know,
and,
or how
hard
he
worked that day.
Which, you know, that's something we can touch on too. This movie really gets right social media
yeah.
and how it's,
oh, it's
used
a huge part of
today.
It.
And even that idea of how we're all just so dying for validation that, you know, you see it all the time. We follow people. We're probably guilty of it ourselves, where you know you have something important you should be doing, and instead of doing it, you tweet something about how, well, I should be doing this,
oh,
but
sure,
instead
sure.
I'm eating this sandwich. Right. Hashtag nom nom nom, like it is here in this movie. Uh-huh. That's great. I love those little touches. But the movie does specifically show, as he's coming back to his house, and it's been a while since I've seen it, so I don't have the exact sequence here, but we watch him pass a kid on the street, I think, and then he goes by a guy in the driveway who is maybe washing his car or something, and he sees a pet somewhere along the way. There's a real precision to the sequence that caught my eye. Well, then sure enough, at the end of the film, when he's in a completely different neighborhood in a completely different country, the sequence pretty much plays out exactly the same way. He sees the guy in the driveway, the kid, and the dog, and it does suggest that how an artist is made, to get to what you said. The two people here in question were raised in these almost identical neighborhoods, but grew up to be very different people. And of course that's true, because there's very rarely an obvious answer for why one person would struggle with mental illness or why one person would grow up to be a great artist. In the case of John, he's trying to explain it. He's trying to rationalize it, and he creates a backstory. But it's probably just that. It is just a story. It's this narrative that he's created for himself.
And we should mention the director is Lenny Abrahamson, and he has that parallel sequence makes me think of it, because there's some sly humor to how he balances those that I think he brings to the movie overall. It may sound like a pretty heavy film from the topics we've talked about thus far, but the tone here is really well handled, where there are jokes and gags, some of which do use the head itself, the mask, but not to a point of, you know, exploiting it. And they all pay off in the end. They come together in the end, too. So I think there's a real mastery of tone to the film that I appreciated. But to go back to your comment about social media, what that also does, it also deflates a myth, too, in the sense that it asks, you know, what is a Twitter follower really worth?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a pretty cruel sequence after John has been generating interest via YouTube and via Twitter in this band that really hasn't had much of a following beforehand.
No.
And he keeps
pointing
out—
They're a creation. They're a social media creation, essentially.
They really are. Yeah. They really are. And he keeps pointing out, well, look at how many people are following us. How many people have watched our videos? And eventually they do get invited to South by Southwest. And so it seems like this is real, tangible success. And at one point, John runs into someone at a diner or something like that who says, I recognize you from the videos. And he gets this, he kind of sits up a little bit like he's ready for his moment of fame. And the guy basically responds as if they are actors in a really bad sitcom that he's been enjoying, ironically.
Yeah.
And there's a cruel truth to that, in that how we present ourselves, it goes back to your introduction, the masks we wear, how we present ourselves, we think that we're getting control then of personas and really allowing people to see us as we want them to see us, when in fact we're a creation of theirs just as much. And when that scene hits John, I mean, it's really a rough scene.
Yeah, it is. And to that point about social media, there's an instance too where we see some tweets on screen that aren't his tweets. We've been seeing those throughout.
Yeah.
But he gets some responses and he throws out something on Twitter where he's looking for genuine help with something. And the movie perfectly captures the spectrum that you would absolutely get in that moment, where one response is someone just being a prankster. One response is someone genuinely trying to help. Another person who's just totally clueless and uses it as an opportunity to talk about whatever they want to talk about. You've got another person who's a total asshole and uses it as a forum to be that, which of course they're going to do. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film, Frank, starring Michael Fassbender. I mentioned the word validation earlier, and the character John, his need for it. And I think one of the other questions this movie asks is not just how an artist is made, but who do we make art for and why? And it makes me think of a line, I couldn't find the exact quote, but something from Bullets Over Broadway, I think it is the Woody Allen film, where at one point he's talking, the John Cusack character, the playwright, is talking to his artist friends. And I think they're talking about a painter who they're kind of praising because he makes these works of art and then he just destroys them. And they act as if that's really what it should be all about. And it does make you wonder, is creating art all about the act of creation itself? Is that the process that matters? Or is it in someone else deciding it's good? Do you need that audience interaction or not? And Maggie Gyllenhaal in this film plays Clara, who is a theremin player. You don't hear that much anymore. So when we talk about this band being avant-garde,
which John doesn't even recognize, to show you his level of musicianship.
Her instruments really are the theremin and hatred.
Yes.
And loathing.
Yes.
And Gyllenhaal plays them pretty well. And she hates the John character, which there are times where it seems totally unreasonable and mean. He's a likable enough guy and his heart's in the right place. So why is she so against him? And I think it does come down to the fact that she can recognize just how badly he needs that validation. Mm-hmm. He needs approval. He's so desperate for it. He needs someone to tell him
his art,
his music's
needs an
okay.
audience.
Yeah.
Theirs doesn't.
Right. And she doesn't think that's what it's about. And that need of his, she just finds so repugnant. And it occurs to me that they kind of are the two halves of Frank's psyche in a way, right? Because there is an inherent contradiction in wearing a mask, in hiding yourself, but doing something on stage for people to appreciate or not appreciate. And John and Clara represent kind of the warring sides, I think, of what we eventually see is Frank's true psyche. He's someone who wants to be loved. He genuinely does want an audience and want people to love him, but at the same time, he can't stop himself from resisting that love and actually doing whatever he can to destroy it.
Well, let me ask you this. What point at the film did you start to think, and maybe it was right at the beginning, but did you start to think that Frank was seriously disturbed in a way that his own sense of self wasn't even cohesive? Because the way we're presented him is the same way John comes to know him, as this eccentric, but he's like a prop savant is how the band treats him. Like, this guy is a genius. And the fact that he wears this giant head, well, we don't know why. We don't really question why. His art is so great that it's beyond, it's out of the question. But I think at the end of the film, really all of his art then comes under question when we learn things. And and that's what I think is so beautiful about that final scene, is the improvisatory lyrics that are part of Frank's technique. When we first see them, and there's a great scene where he looks at a tuft coming up from a piece of rug and he improvises a song, and John is just blown away. And we're kind of, at least I was, captured in that spell too. Like, man, look, this guy can, you know, just ring a little bit of poetry. You know, it's not brilliant, but it's a little bit of poetry out of anything. And they play that completely differently in the ending. Not that one is worse than the other, but we definitely see it through a different lens.
Well, I think that gets at what the movie is ultimately asking us to contend with a little bit, in terms of the idea that the more we know about the personalities behind the art, the more it can affect the art itself.
Sure.
And that's probably not a really good thing. If it's really, at the end of the day, about the art itself, it's about the music, then why does it matter who the person is who is singing those words?
It's really a matter of packaging, isn't it?
It is.
The movie points out how much we're affected by the packaging, whether it's the background bio we know of a singer, whatever it is they're wearing on stage, if we're just talking about music, the art of music right now, how all of these things influence us. We may deny it. We may say we don't judge the book by its cover, but I think this movie exposes that for us.
Yeah, it definitely does. Just the act of watching this film, seeing this character wearing that head, it deconstructs the relationship of the artist to the audience. And I think it does suggest that maybe you don't need to know the artist, where you are immediately, when you're seeing that face, that's enough to draw conclusions. Whether they're right or wrong, you start to form your own opinions and your interpretations of his or her life. And then that starts to inform the work in ways that are probably not really beneficial to anybody or fruitful in any way. And I don't think it's an accident, if we get back to Fassbender, that they cast someone who's as popular right now, who's as recognizable and big a presence as Michael Fassbender is. It makes me think, actually, of Under the Skin. We talked about how, I don't think it's an accident, clearly, Jonathan Glazer said it here on the show, the director, that for a movie that's dealing with how we as a culture fetishize female bodies, he cast probably the actress whose body and whose look is most fetishized in our culture today. Here you've got Fassbender, whose face and his body, I think, is similarly fetishized. And I did come across an interesting idea from Abramson about seeing Fassbender's face as a Wizard of Oz moment, where he says it's not, though, the little man hiding behind the curtain, right? It's this enormously good-looking, perfectly put together celebrity that we all revere as soon as we see him. Now, we knew he was behind there anyway, but I think the suspension of disbelief as you go through the film and you start to really have to wrestle with who this guy is under there. You kind of forget that it's Michael Fassbender.
Right.
When he does take off the mask, there is this sort of fracture where you as an audience member have to wrestle with the fact that that guy could be so crippled by self-doubt and feel the need artistically to hide behind the head. What's driving that? Mm-hmm. Why would he need to feel that way? What does it say about our culture? Again, how we do interpret personalities of the artist, how we interpret the work through that lens. The fact that he takes off the head and that's who it is substantial in and of itself.
I do like, though, the little detail of physical damage that is also when we see his face. I think that helps us make that transition just a little bit, because it is different from Scarlett Johansson in the fact that this character she's playing under the skin is still supposed to be a seductive figure.
Mm-hmm.
She's supposed to be Scarlett Johansson. Here, he's not necessarily supposed to be Michael Fassbender.
Mm-hmm.
He has some of those physical attributes for sure. And again, in that final scene, I think he does work those famous eyes quite a bit to sell that song. But he also is a character who has been living for decades with this crippling self-doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has to show as well. It really is a remarkable performance. And it's a pantomime for much of it. But I like how he plays each of the scenes with varying levels of confidence. So you do get a sense, looking back at it now, I could probably tell better that this is a guy who is on the edge more than maybe I initially mm-hmm. thought, because you see how Fassbender plays some moments where he's supremely confident as Frank. And that's often in the middle of a song when the band is behind him and he's in his element.
Yeah.
And maybe the mask has allowed him to forget to a degree that there's an audience out there. But then there are other moments when he's talking one-on-one with someone and you can see that he's a little bit more unsure.
Mm-hmm.
But the concert scenes themselves are just fantastic. The actors, from what I understand, it's Fassbender singing and the other actors playing their instruments. And you really can sense that sort of communal creation going on early on. And Fassbender is just such a striking figure.
He is.
With that mask on his head. The comparison I thought of, his movements remind me of David Byrne in a lot of ways and the use of props. But it's also like a balloon head. So he's almost as if there's a Thanksgiving Day Macy's Parade version of David Byrne going down the street. I just love the concert scenes.
I do too. And he's got a powerful enough voice. Of course, we've seen that in the X-Men movies. I talked about how my favorite scene in the recent X-Men movie was the one where he's just talking to James McAvoy and raises his voice on the airplane. But on the physical side, there's a scene later in X-Men where he is Magneto, does something with a baseball stadium, and that's pantomime. It's
mm-hmm.
complete pantomime.
True.
He doesn't say anything. He just stands there with his mask on and the silly outfit, and he stands there as Michael Fassbender and waves his arms, and all this magic happens. And of course, it's the magic of CGI, but it is so believable and is so fun to watch just because of the presence of Michael Fassbender. So even with that muffled mask on, the voice and the physical movement comes through and makes it a performance to really enjoy. I do love as well, you talked about the tone of the film. You're right, the comedy does come through and it needs to kind of undercut the heaviness of some of what's going on. And whether it was by design completely or not, we do get even that classic Spinal Tap shot where his first night with the band, they're all on stage already and the camera follows him from behind, the John character, as he tries to get from the backstage door up through the inner workings of this club onto the stage. And just like those Spinal Tap characters, he's pretty much completely lost and has no clue what he's doing. So you get that sense of helplessness and futility there with that character. The one thing I really wanted to go back and watch the movie again to see if it bothered me as much, and it really obviously didn't bother me much at all, but it was something that stood out to me, and I don't know if on a second viewing it would, is there is a reliance, understandably, on montage to compress long periods of time. They stay at that cabin out in the middle of nowhere recording their album for months and months. And obviously, I think it's almost a year. They can't really capture that on screen in a normal feature film running time. So they compress it. But what happens in the act of compressing that is we have to take the narrator's word for just how brilliant Frank is all the time and just how much of an impact his brilliance is having on John. We have to just believe it when he says it. I'm learning so much and look at my evolution as a character. Of course, we see it on screen. We see it in the music. We see it in their interactions. But the montage does as I said, it undercuts it a little bit by making it something we just have to accept in voiceover, where you don't get to see it as much. And when a guy's wearing a head and he's hard enough to read anyway, you really want to see those moments where he opens up the character's eyes to something, where he really does make the world and the heavens part so that he has some kind of revelation.
Maybe we don't get to see it because it's not really happening. That's one of the central questions, right? I mean, is there any magic here? That's what I'm not sure of. I can tell you how I responded to the final scene and how I responded to the music itself. But again, that's because it's coming within the packaging of a movie I've been appreciating named Frank.
Right.
I mean, this isn't the sort of music I would normally listen to or would attract my attention necessarily. So I can't say that it has that going for it, yet I fell for it. Why?
Yeah.
Why do I think this is good music? Well, because of how the movie packaged it and presented it.
You're kind of suggesting that maybe the need to construct this narrative is so strong that
it was in his head.
Yeah, because he believes that he's having this transformative
experience. That's what he needs at this point in his life, right?
That
this is he found this band, he signed up with them, and this was going to define him as a musician.
He's going to make it happen, even if it's not going to happen.
Exactly.
Yeah, no,
and
I think that's fair.
And that's probably true to some degree of the creative process.
Well, this music for me too, I will say, because I noticed on Letterboxd where you were having a little bit of a disagreement with a listener who didn't enjoy the movie at all and really hated the music.
Yeah.
I'm with you that that kind of avant-garde music isn't something I put in my CD player or my iPhone and listen to regularly, though I have been to some avant-garde performances. But I can appreciate it. And one of the things I really appreciate about this movie, and we'll get into this a little bit more probably when we get to our top five movie bands, is I always want to believe the band on screen. I really need to believe that they're actually playing the instruments and that it's coming from them and it's not being completely artificially manufactured. And it's all coming from them.
Right.
And it's all good. Good in the sense that it does require musicianship.
Yeah.
And they are actually making music. Now, again, whether or not you appreciate it or like it, that's a whole nother question. It may not be your cup of tea, but there is something legitimate about the music that you can't just discard because they're making funny noises.
Well, and a credit to that for me was the fact that the final song they sing together in the final scene of the film comes up at the end of the credits, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the start of the end credits. And I was glad. I try to sit through the end credits as often as I can, but I don't always do it. But when I heard that song starting up again, I was like, well, I'm going to sit here and listen to this.
Well, if you do want to hear that song, they did perform it as a band on the Colbert Report a week or so ago. And I did catch that performance. The exact band here, Donald Gleason, Maggie Gyllenhaal, and Michael Fassbender with the papier-mâché head on.
Madrid, it's nice to see you. It's really nice to be here. I love you more.
Frank is currently playing here in Chicago and in limited release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
We'll get to our latest poll questions next, which feature some mano-a-mano face-offs. Adam versus producer Sam Van Halgren, and then Christopher Nolan versus Paul Thomas Anderson. Plus, I'll try to justify the fact that I'm one of the very few critics who actually likes Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. Stay with us. Quick interruption here, everybody, to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is presented by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code FILM.
So the last time I put out the call on Twitter for testimonials, people who love Film Spotting and love Squarespace, I did enjoy getting this response from our buddy Keith Phipps over at The Dissolve, who says, I've never used Squarespace, but it sponsors all my favorite podcasts, so if I ever did start my own website, I'd use it.
Well, there you go. We'll
great
hold you to that, Keith.
Yeah, apparently starting The Dissolve doesn't qualify as his own website, but that was funny. Thank you, Keith. Gary McCurry, though, he's a listener who's not joking, Josh. He says, Squarespace is professional, simple, and very easy to use, even for the less tech-minded. His website is wasitgood.sqsp.com, and we'll link to that in our show notes. Very clean website. He reviews movies there, and he doesn't post very often, but when Gary does, he really does get into some detail on the movies, and it's great to see that he's using Squarespace for that endeavor. What you'll find if you use Squarespace, They're constantly improving their platform with new features and designs and even better support. All their designs automatically include a unique mobile experience, so your content will look great on every device every time. And they do have the great Squarespace Metric app for iPhone and iPad that gives you the chance to check site stats like page views, unique visitors, and social media follows. They also recently added a commerce tool, so if you want to set up a shop and sell things, you can do that in just a matter of minutes. It's all incredibly easy to use. Support 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It all starts at just $8 a month and does include a free domain name if you sign up for 1 year.
You can start a trial without a credit card. You just start building your own website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FILM to get 10% off and to show your support for Film Spotting. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
Sky and wonder at our place in the stars. Now we just look down and worry about our place in the dirt.
Go for our main engine. Start T-minus 10.
We must confront the reality that nothing in our solar system can help us.
Nine.
You're listening to Film Spotting, and we hate to be the ones to break it to you, but it's Labor Day weekend. Summer is over. Put away the flip-flops and the fancy white slacks, Josh. I am talking to you, though. I doubt you own any white slacks.
You're usually
the guy that likes a lot of colors in his pants.
I do, but what's with slacks? Who uses...
I don't know.
We were actually just talking about this with friends over the weekend. That's not a term anyone... Hey, I know your birthday is coming up and you're aging rapidly, but slacks?
Well, slacks, old conventional wisdom, like not wearing white after Labor Day, it fits.
That's true.
It fits,
all right,
Josh.
I'll give you that.
But we're going to go ahead and let you watch Guardians of the Galaxy for the seventh time. That also doesn't apply to you, Josh.
No.
On next week's show, we'll mark the change in movie seasons with our fall movie preview, a season that includes the release of the film you just heard a short clip from, Christopher Nolan's Interstellar, starring, apparently, the overrated and overexposed Matthew McConaughey. I don't know who says he's overrated.
That's Guardians of the Galaxy, overrated and overexposed.
Okay. No, he's definitely not overrated. We've got Interstellar in a death match against another big fall slash early winter release when we get to polls in just a little bit. First, a couple quick notes. We did want to mention, in the wake of our top five Robin Williams scenes, our tribute to Robin Williams, many people wrote in and noted on Twitter that it was worth sharing with our audience if they weren't already aware of it, the interview he did with Marc Maron on an old episode of WTF. And as it turns out, it was one that I hadn't caught up with. I wasn't listening to WTF regularly back when that episode happened. I think it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I have been listening for the past 2 or 3 years, and I was glad to see that Marc reposted that show following his death. And it is. It's great. It's really good. If you listen to anything about Robin Williams, along with our show, hopefully, I encourage you to listen to that. The Fresh Air interview with Terry Gross that they replayed, also very good, but just with Marc being there, sitting right across from him, mm-hmm. and getting into a little bit more of the deeper territory, if you will, I think that interview is a must listen. And if you haven't already heard it, we will link to that in our show notes at filmspotting.net. We also wanted to plug our sister podcast. They call us Original Recipe. I don't have a catchy nickname for
Did
SVU.
You say sister?
It is SVU. They're our sister show. Streaming Video Unit. As many of you know, we do have this bi-weekly spinoff podcast. They cover the world of online movies. It's hosted by our pals BuzzFeed's Allison Wilmore and Matt Singer from The Dissolve.
On the most recent show, Matt and Allison review the new Netflix miniseries Southcliffe, which is from director Sean Durkin. That's the man behind our favorite Martha Marcy May Marlene. And every week they also talk about movies that are new to streaming. This week, that would include A Hard Day's Night, Midnight Run, and Jeff Nichols' Mud. More information about Film Spotting SVU can be found on our website. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes.
Well, it is deathmatch time then. Back in January, as we looked ahead to the most anticipated films of the year, 2014 overall, we posed a Mr. Anderson deathmatch between Wes Anderson's Grand Budapest Hotel, which at that point hadn't been released yet, and Paul Thomas Anderson's Inherent Vice, which at that point we really knew almost nothing about, only that it was an adaptation of a 2009 Thomas Pynchon novel, and it appeared to star Joaquin Phoenix along with a huge ensemble cast. That's still all I know.
We're sort of only hoping that it would even come out this year, right? That hadn't been confirmed.
Yeah. PTA won that death match by a comfortable margin, 60% to 40%. And despite not knowing much more about the movie than we did back in January, Inherent Vice moves on to the championship round of this death match against Interstellar. It's Nolan's first non-Dark Knight project since Inception and his first non-summer release since 2006, The Prestige. Interstellar is slated to come out November 7th. Inherent Vice will have its world premiere at the New York Film Festival at the end of September, and it's slated to open wide December 12th. So that is the poll. Quite simply, which movie? You can only go see one. That's all you have time for. The other one just disappears completely. Is it the PTA film or is it the Christopher Nolan film?
This is cruel. I mean, I did list Interstellar as my most anticipated film of the year, but that was after we had already set aside a handful of titles, of which Inherent Vice was one. So I haven't really had to make this decision yet. And now you're making me.
I'm looking at you, Josh.
Okay, Interstellar, I suppose I could argue has the bigger canvas in a sense.
Well, it's the universe.
Exactly.
Right?
It feels like a
or at least
filmmaker taking a big swing, whereas maybe that's what you would have described The Master as when you first heard about it. It maybe didn't end up being this, but at that time it was Paul Thomas Anderson's movie about Scientology, which sounded pretty ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this being Nolan's 2001 is the way it's sort of being talked about. Maybe I would go with that vote. But that's not to say that Anderson is working with light material here. I mean, it's, you know,
so you're equivocating.
Novel. All right, the vote is Interstellar, but I'm not confident about it.
Okay, well, I'm confident. I mean, I put two Paul Thomas Anderson films on my top five films of the film spotting
era. So,
let's move on. We want to know what you think, though. You can vote now at filmspotting.net.
What did it feel like?
What?
Murdering an innocent man. I just want to know what it felt like. It must have been beautiful.
What are you talking about, innocence?
I knew I could count on you. Sex always made you stupid, ready to believe anything. You've just made me a very rich woman. Do me one last favor, lover. Stay still long enough for me to blow your brains out.
Sex and violence there in one 30-second clip. Ladies and gentlemen, there is Sin City. Josh, that was the very talented Eva Green with Josh Brolin in a scene from the new Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, the sequel to the 2005 adaptation of the Frank Miller graphic novels. We'll get to your thoughts on the new film in just a bit. But first, let's take a look at the blood splattered results of last week's poll question. In anticipation of this release, which, according to last week's box office, almost no one was anticipating, we asked you this. Which 2005 Sin City review from Film Spotting do you most agree with? The choices were, Josh,
Sam's, in which he called it misogynist, frequently boring, with an utter lack of intelligence or wit, or Adams, who said it has an amazing sense of inertia and is complex in the way it handles violence and revenge.
Well, 42% going with Sam, 58% going with me in favor of the original Sin City.
And I apologize, Sam, but I had to vote that way, too.
Yeah, you did. You liked it.
The only thing about Sam's review here, and I'm sure he had much more to say in the discussion, but frequently boring, that makes
Never.
No sense. Utter lack of intelligence or wit, neither of those apply.
No.
Now, I understand the misogynist argument. I don't agree with
of
it.
Of course.
But I get it. And
I don't
maybe,
agree with it either.
And maybe that's the only one that matters of that list of what Sam had to say, but right there, that's not really a strong argument.
Chris Massa says, my vote in the poll went with Adam, but my honest reaction is more like this. I enjoyed Sin City so much on a visceral level, so much as sheer entertainment, that I never felt the need to analyze it too much. I didn't feel like it was trying to say anything meaningful about violence or revenge. It set out to be a unique, one-of-a-kind, visionary piece of entertainment, and as that, I thought it was a complete success.
I don't know if it meant to either, but that doesn't mean that it didn't end up saying something. Joe Osborne wrote in, this is a case where my opinion has shifted significantly over time. In 2005, when I was 18, I loved Sin City and sided with Adam, despite agreeing with Sam that the film's approach to its female characters left a lot to be desired. But still, it was an exhilarating ride, so I gave it a pass on that front. But as the years pass, the film seems increasingly juvenile and sexist, and I find myself wishing that Robert Rodriguez hadn't recreated Frank Miller's worst tendencies so faithfully on screen. It's still a striking, beautifully directed film, but Miller's content isn't aging well in my eyes, so I'm siding with Sam this time.
Hmm. Sam in Martinez, California says, I voted for Adam's take, but I would really agree with a happy medium. I love the noir atmosphere, and the movie is a lot of fun, but complex in the way it handles violence and revenge? I don't know about that, Adam. In fairness to me, I also said more than that in our original discussion back on episode 5 of this show. And I think I spent a lot of time trying to articulate what I meant by that. I'm not saying I'll convince anyone or that it was even halfway intelligent, but it wasn't just some comment I threw off trying to argue that the movie actually had some depth to it. I really believed it, and I tried to express it anyway. So who knows? I'm never going to go back and listen to that show, so someone else will have to tell me if I pulled it off at all.
One more note here from Dave Bjorling. I have only one positive comment about Sin City. It looked good. The film is totally amoral, and for you kiddies out there, that is not a compliment. I hated it.
There you go.
Well,
okay.
I'm hearing a lot of that about the most recent one. That's
we'll get
for
there.
Sure.
We'll get there. We do thank everyone who voted in that poll and to those of you who left your fine comments. I even thank Scott, Josh. He is the guy who left the comment where he chided me for apparently misusing the word inertia. Because inertia,
really?
It does come, you know, we get the word inert from it, and that's not at all what I'm trying to say. And I read that comment, and I just sat there in horror for a second thinking, wow, did I really get that completely wrong? Am I a total idiot? And it would make sense that I would, because I am the guy, after all, who spent 4 years as an English major at a liberal arts institution that doesn't require its students to take any general education classes outside of its major.
Uh-huh.
They just trust that you're going to be a well-rounded liberal arts student and take things like math and science classes. I did not.
Okay.
I took advantage of the system and didn't take a single science class. But, Josh, I look it up.
What is the dictionary definition of inertia?
The property of matter by which it retains its state of rest or its velocity along a straight line so long as it is not acted upon by an external force. So my whole point is the movie just starts going. The movie starts going and it never lets up. It's a straight line, a constant velocity through to the end of the movie. So I think I got it right.
Yeah, sorry, Scott. I think he's okay there.
If the film is by Wes Anderson, then it will make his list. Or from Pixar or Disney, well, you get the gist. But heavy-handed messages really aren't his thing. Time for Larson Recommends on Film Spotting.
Our longtime listener and jingle contributor, Joran Kane, he heard our outtake last week at the end of the podcast, Josh, where we talked about some of the old jingles we had that he produced for Maddie's Movie Minute, Adam's Articulate Analysis. Apparently, you know, it was time for Larson Recommends to not just have the little instrumental jingle we got from another listener that we really enjoyed, but a full-blown song. And we love it, so
we are going to get an album out of this, aren't we? You know, the thing about it is it's so pleasant to listen to, and that now here I am following that up, talking about Disney and Pixar, recommending Sin City.
A Dame to Kill For.
It doesn't quite fit, does it?
It doesn't. But to set you up a little bit here, we're going to find out if you truly are recommending Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, because this is a movie, and I'm not at all suggesting that the goal here should be consensus. I'm just trying to lay the groundwork a little bit that your take may be a little bit contrarian, because you look at Rotten Tomatoes, 45%. Metacritic, a score of 45. Nathan Rabin from The Dissolve, our pal, been on the show before, said this about Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. It's difficult to overstate the utter worthlessness and repulsiveness of the original Sin City's late-in-the-works sequel, Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, and how hateful, stupid, and misogynistic it is in every facet of its storytelling. It is so egregiously awful, so utterly without merit, that it makes its predecessor seem much worse by association. The film's brainless, chest-beating brand of hyper-pulp calls into question whether Sin City was any good at all, or whether the novelty of its visuals and storytelling merely masked a howling nothingness at its core. Zero stars.
Zero stars, I know, that's what I was going to say. I don't know if they've had one on The Dissolve. A zero-star review, have they?
It must be awful, Josh. Tell me it's not.
It's not awful. I mean, the gap between those who hate this movie and those like me who find it significantly inferior to the original Sin City but still having decent qualities, that I don't understand that at all. Now, if you found the original film, as Sam did, misogynist and hateful, then
There's
more of it. Exactly. This is not the movie that's going to win anybody over to the world of Sin City. I thought the one thing it was lacking is that Sin City had a conviction to its depravity in a way that was really disturbing, but also in a way that you had to admire, in that it was sincerely going after the depths of what a city like this would be, what those original noir movies were about but couldn't show us. That was the crux of it for me.
There's darkness to it that is human and identifiable.
And honest. Awful, and the movie was interested in dealing with it. This Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, all that stuff's painted on. It's splashed onto it. It's put on top. It doesn't rise from inside it or seep out of it. And so that definitely makes it inferior. And the storyline with Eva Green is more squeamish in the way it follows the film noir femme fatale character to a really disturbing end. Like, if you're going to – these women who were manipulative and deceitful in the original noirs, what might they be like in an explicit R-rated, you know, no production code restrictions at all? And where that goes and how it sort of combines sex and violence, I can see raises more questions to me than some of that stuff did in the original Sin City. Now, at the same time – a lot of what I liked about the original is still here, including the stylishness, including the use of 3D, which is new. A lot of it looks quite the same, but the 3D is new. And I got to say, it sort of worked for me. And I'm not a proponent of 3D at all. The smoke in a bar, there's layers like cumulus clouds behind the characters that I noticed. The opening titles really benefit from the 3D. And Rodriguez and Frank Miller, who also gets a co-director credit, make a lot of use of silhouettes here that are just astonishing. There's a shot of Brolin's character getting a punch, and all of a sudden he turns into this white silhouette, which fades into the gleam of a streetlight on the side of a passing car, which stretches to the car door that opens, and Brolin's suddenly thrown out. And that happens in like 8 seconds. I mean, whatever you feel about the movie's worldview, I don't see how you can discredit and go to 0 stars and say there's no artistry here. Mm-hmm. Now, what value you put on each of those, that's an open question. So I guess I am curious. I would love to hear from someone who really, really liked Sin City and just despises A Dame to Kill For. I've looked at a couple of reviews. I've talked to someone on Letterboxd who has made that shift. And it was more than the listener we heard from who said they've grown out of it. Mm-hmm. They had a different argument, that there were structural issues. And that I can see, too. Some of the story strands here are stronger than the other, and it's not bookended as nicely. So it's inferior. But if you did appreciate the original one, I don't quite see why this one would leave you frothing at the mouth.
Okay. Well, I am going to catch up with it hopefully soon, and we'll see if it leaves me frothing at the mouth, as I am one of those people who really like the
first
one.
I hope you do. And maybe you'll be that person who can point out to me, you know, what is missing so hugely between them.
Well, in the meantime, you can send us your thoughts about Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. You can email us anytime, feedback@filmspotting.net.
We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, we're wearing sunglasses, and we're already in Chicago. Ready to share our favorite movie bands?
Hit it.
The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
We're so glad to see so many of you lovely people here tonight. And we would especially like to welcome all the representatives of Illinois' law enforcement community who have chosen to join us here in the Palace Hotel Ballroom at this time. We do sincerely hope you all enjoy the show. And please remember, people, that no matter who you are and what you do to live, thrive, and survive, there are still some things that make us all the same.
Josh, let's spend a minute or two here on thank yous. It is donation time, and this will be fairly quick after we've had an onslaught of donations building up around the 500th show. We do have a new $5 a month subscriber, Betty Joe. I think Betty Joe is in Western New York. I'm just throwing it out there.
Meaning Western's the name of the town?
No.
Or the Western section of New York?
You got it.
Okay.
The latter. Silver Club donation from Eric in Cameron Park, California, and that could be in the western part of California. I don't know.
Is there a Western? It's all Western, isn't it?
You're right. It's all Western, Josh. Finally, a Silver Club donation from Joe in Natick, Massachusetts, with a really nice note.
With 2 kids under 3, my time to watch movies is limited. So when a movie like The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp arrives at my door with a runtime of 2 hours and 45 minutes, it feels like film spotting homework, a movie I have to endure to maintain my cinephile cred. After completing the film, in three separate sittings, of course, all I can say is, wow. What a performance by Roger Livesey as General Clive Candy, a role that spans 40 years and three wars. Equally as important, the filmmaking on display by Powell and Pressburger was far more innovative and stylistic than I would have expected from a film made in 1943. This is a true film spotting discovery. To be honest, the film has been languishing in my Netflix queue since 2010. My God, that's 4 years. And I've pushed it to the bottom of the list more than once. But after hearing several brief plugs on the show, I finally allowed it to filter back to the top. I'm so glad I did. It's a new favorite. Thank you, Film Spotting, for continuing to champion forgotten gems like this one and for producing the best film podcast anywhere. Listening to you makes work commutes, 5 mile runs, and long car rides to the in-laws downright pleasurable.
Well, thanks for that note, Joe. It's obviously great to hear someone dive into a movie like The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. And I remember when we did the Powell Pressburger Marathon here on the show, I saw that running time. I'm the same way. I have to watch movies that are 2.5 hours plus in multiple sittings. It's very rare that I just get to sit down at home and take in something that's almost 3 hours long, but it didn't matter. It didn't change my experience at all or didn't hurt it in any way. The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp is really just a masterpiece, I think. And I reiterate that if you're someone, and basically everyone out there who has seen it except for me, if you love the Grand Budapest Hotel, I think the Powell and Pressburger Colonel Blimp influence is all over that film. I would also say that, and I think I did say this on a past Top 5, best movie friendship ever on screen is Roger Livesey and Anton Walbrook in The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. So thank you again, Joe, very much for that. And thanks to everyone who donated. Even if you are one of our recurring donors, you don't get mentioned every week, but $2 a month, $5 a month, some people even $10 a month, Josh, it really does keep us doing what we're doing. And if you're not a donor, but you still want to help the show, it never hurts to rate us on iTunes, leave a comment. It does help us get new listeners. Josh, a couple quick notes I want to work into this segment here. We are going to share some bonus content. I'm not going to promise exactly what we'll get into, but we have three different topics we could touch on.
Okay. Sounds promising.
And I'll see what I can convince you to dive into. One is a great email we got inspired by our 500th show and the Revenge of the Sith and all the Star Wars talk about what order the film should be watched.
Oh, yeah.
You posed that question,
to
Ryan Johnson. So this email gives us a new perspective, not just going 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, or 1 through 6. We'll get to that. We also got a question from a listener looking for advice for aspiring film critics. Might dive into that topic. We also have a great batch of email on one of our recent top fives, pre-CGI scenes. Michael
that
is here.
I missed, yeah.
That you missed. So I would like to get your perspective on that top five. We may get to all of that. We may get to only some of it. I guess you'll have to check out the bonus content, which is available if you have the Film Spotting app. All the info you need is at filmspotting.net and just click on apps. We were also challenged this week, Josh, and we both kind of knew it was coming.
Yes.
A listener, Joe Heiser, on Twitter, did challenge us in the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, and neither of us are man enough to actually get doused with a cold bucket of ice water.
We're not getting tattoos, and we're not getting doused with ice water.
Well, there's still time for tattoos. There's still time.
That you claim you would do.
And there's still time to convince you, Josh. It's going to be episode 1,000.
There you go. On stage.
On stage. Come on.
See, that's the most energized I've seen you about the prospect of 500 more shows.
It's going to drive me for another decade, Josh. But thank you, Joe, for that. And although we aren't going to do it, we did both donate. So
yeah,
I mean, ALS got some money.
The whole thing is getting out of hand. Somebody challenged my dog. Someone was my daughter. So,
well,
yeah. A lot of donations are flowing out of the Larson household.
I guess so.
Hi, this is Todd Haynes, the director of I'm Not There, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Now, during the Flower People period, who was your drummer? Stumpy's replacement, Peter James Bond. He also died in mysterious circumstances. We were playing a festival. Jazz blues festival. Where was that?
Blues jazz, really.
Blues jazz festival.
It was in the Isle of Lucy. And it was tragic, really. He exploded on stage.
Just like that?
He just went up.
He just was like a flash of green light. And that was it. Nothing was left.
Look at his face.
Well, there was.
It's true. This truly did happen.
There was a little green globule on his drum seat.
Like a stain, really.
It was more of a stain than a globule, actually.
Dozens of people spontaneously combust each year. It's just not really widely reported.
Right.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. That's David and Nigel, of course, from Rob Reiner's classic comedy, This is Spinal Tap. And this top five, our top five movie bands, of course, is going to be the Spinal Tap Memorial List. So off limits, because it would just be my slam dunk number one, Josh.
Who was your co-host when you reviewed Spinal Tap?
It's a tragic story, Josh. Might have to save that one for bonus. This top five is inspired by our review earlier in the show of the new film, Frank. And there aren't a whole lot of rules here. We are talking about movie bands that are fictional. That is one restriction, so you're not going to have any biopics. And I also did focus on bands, as the title suggests, or groups, not just individual artists. So even though I really like DJ, Terrence Howard's character in Hustle and Flow, not eligible for this list. He really is a solo performer. So movie bands, fictional bands, who's your number five?
My number five, well, when this list came up, I immediately thought of the Blues Brothers, but I wasn't sure if they met the criteria. They're, you know, they debuted as sort of a fake band on Saturday Night Live and then became something of a real band alongside the movie in a way. So I decided doesn't quite fit for me, but that was okay because actually my favorite band in the Blues Brothers isn't the Blues Brothers. It's the movie's church choir headlined by that ringer of a pastor, James Brown.
By the day of the Lord cometh as a thief in the night.
This is the scene where Jake, John Belushi, literally sees the light during a church service and he gets inspired to get the band back together. It culminates after the church erupts and all the parishioners are dancing. It does culminate in this great group dance number. Even Jake and Elwood join in. They're all dancing down the aisles. The Blues Brothers features a ton of brilliant musical guests. You've got Ray Charles, you've got Aretha Franklin. Makes me think we've got to be getting our Aretha Franklin biopic any day now, don't we?
Maybe.
The way things have been going. But when I was a kid at least, and I would watch the Blues Brothers over and over on WGN, it was the Reverend Cleophas James and his church choir. They were my favorite band. That was my favorite musical sequence. So they're going to get my number five slot.
I think it's an inspired choice. A couple other bands we should note that aren't going to be eligible for our list. Because of the Pantheon, the film spotting list of movies that are off limits because we feature them too much or they're just too good. No Cantina Band from Star Wars A New Hope, which has a name.
Yeah, they do. It was a frequently suggested band on Twitter.
Figrin Dan and the Modal Nodes.
Did you know that was their name?
No,
I didn't either.
And that was surely just made up by somebody, right? That's what fans call it. I don't know the history and the derivation of that name, but they're not eligible. It's in the Pantheon. Also, if you're a big fan of Autobahn from The Big Lebowski, not eligible.
I saw that one too.
And I know everybody here is just waiting for me to list Stillwater.
Uh-huh.
Almost Famous.
That's your number one?
They're just waiting for me to get to that as my number one, find another reason to talk about that Cameron Crowe movie. But here's the thing, Josh. It was very crucial for me, very important, that as I considered my picks, I was really considering the bands and the music and not just the movies that they're in or the personalities of the band members. And I'm sorry, Stillwater, but I don't like the music at all.
Oh.
I don't think they're a good band.
Oh.
No,
wow.
And I think that's appropriate. I think Cameron Crowe
kind of part of the point.
Yeah, he
right.
made them appropriately average.
Forgettable.
They're a middling band. I also don't ever believe for a second that Russell, the guitar player played by Billy Crudup, is anywhere close to the musical genius that it suggested he is, because we certainly don't see it or hear it in the film. So Stillwater, not even an honorable mention for me.
Wow, except you just spent a good minute mentioning them.
How
That's
dare
all
you.
Right.
How dare you.
I thought about that as well. And, you know, in my perfect world, it was going to be a band where they worked as a band and they worked for the movie overall, for what the movie was trying to do. They did both of those things.
So Stillwater might apply.
I guess, because the music, you had to like the music too.
Okay.
So not all of my picks fit that perfect criterion, but that's what I was going for.
And we should also give a little bit of credit to a couple websites that recently did similar lists. The Dissolve, our friends over there, shared their favorite fictional movie bands. Each one of the writers there did that. You're going to get some overlap on our list. And also IndieWire, the playlist over there, had 15 great fictional bands and movies. We'll link to those in our show notes if you're curious for more on this topic. There's some good stuff over at both those websites. My number five, a purely nostalgic pick This movie was a critical and box office flop, though the soundtrack, released later, actually ended up being pretty successful, and it was the first movie soundtrack I ever owned, Josh. Eddie and the Cruisers.
Wow.
Talking about a movie, I believe, from 1983, and not only was it the first soundtrack I ever owned, but it did inspire the first band I was ever in. My friend Matt, whose mom babysat me, and my sister Melissa, and he had a couple brothers as well. We used to run around in the summertime doing whatever we wanted, and we loved this movie so much that we decided to start our own band called Adam and the Cruisers.
Oh, come on.
And all we did was put on the soundtrack, and then I would basically go up and lip sync the words into a microphone. But Matt, who still is an amazing drummer and the drummer in my band, and still my best friend, he would actually play the drums, because even at like age 8, he could actually play the drums. So he'd play the drums, I'd sit up there and strum a guitar that I didn't know how to play, and I'd lip sync the words to Eddie and the Cruisers.
Please tell me there's Super 8 of that.
There is no footage of it, and you know why? Because we only had one performance.
Oh,
it was.
You're talking like you guys toured the neighborhood.
No, it was Billy French's family reunion.
Oh my goodness.
And I saw the crowd, all of maybe 12 people assembled in Billy's basement, and I got stage fright, and I called off the gig.
That was the end. I love it.
So, Adam and the Cruisers didn't have much of a future, unfortunately, Josh. But this is a movie, you've probably never even seen it. You don't know what I'm talking about.
I was just going to ask, is it a greater sin to have never seen Eddie and the Cruisers or Roadhouse?
Well, it's a
what
movie
do I need to confess for
well,
first?
Roadhouse, for sure. You
really
need to see that. Yeah,
oh,
that's
boy
a greater sin.
Because
but
I haven't seen Roadhouse in the last 3 weeks. So you're probably shocked at that.
Yeah, I am. Actually, I thought maybe that show would inspire you to finally seek it out. But this is a movie. Maybe this will help get you interested, Josh. It steals heavily, or maybe lightly, from Citizen Kane.
Oh, really?
It takes that whole conceit of the reporter going back to try to piece together the life of this enigmatic person, in this case, the lead singer, Eddie, played by Michael Paré. Ellen Barkin plays the journalist, and she goes and basically talks to all the band members, including one of the key members, Tom Berenger. And this was my introduction to Tom Berenger as an actor. He had been out in The Big Chill the same year in 83, but I, of course, didn't go see The Big Chill. But Eddie and the Cruisers was on HBO or one of those movie channels all the time. And the movie is about a band from the 60s, so there's a lot of flashbacks. Takes place in New Jersey, and they're kind of a Bruce Springsteen meets Dion and the Belmonts sound. And the eventual song that made the soundtrack such a hit and gave the movie a little bit of notoriety was called On the Dark Side. Surely you have actually heard this song if I played it for you, Josh. And the real band playing the music was called John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band.
Better name than Eddie and the Cruisers.
A little bit better. There is a scene on a rooftop early in the film where Tom Berenger has just joined the band, finding his way, finding his voice. And he's playing, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, he's playing On the Dark Side very earnestly. And everybody's laughing at him, and it's just awful. And Eddie sticks up for him, and he sits down at the keyboard and he rocks it up and he shows him exactly how it's done. And he talks about the importance and the power of words and music, Josh, words and music. And I was such a sucker at age 8 for that romanticizing of words and music that movie I probably watched 100 times when I was a kid.
Oh my goodness.
Probably saw it 100 times.
Yikes.
So
well,
there you go.
You know, if Citizen Kane was missing anything, it was middling Jersey rock. I mean, that would have really cemented it as the number one film of all time.
A masterpiece.
If it somehow had
sadly,
that.
Sadly lacking.
Oh, boy. All right. I can't say too much, though. My number 4 is going to be a nostalgic pick as well, though they still play, and I think they still hold up in current movies. It's Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem. I'm picking them from the Muppet movie.
Love it.
They also made their TV debut like the Blues Brothers. They were in the 1975 pilot for The Muppet Show, but they really have been in most of the Muppet movies, have gotten a number or a scene or something. On the Vulture website, Alex Susskind wrote a tribute piece in March that detailed their greatest hits. He described them this way. The Mayhem consisted of 5 members, all loosely based on real-life musicians. Fittingly, Muppet creator Jim Henson voiced the Mayhem's lead singer, Dr. Teeth. The Doctor's deep, gravelly tone and colorful vests were a nod to New Orleans legend Dr. John.
The rest of the group included guitarist and Valley Girl / Janis Joplin hybrid Janis.
Yeah.
Bassist and Beatle freak Sergeant Floyd Pepper. Zoot, a saxophonist who looked like jazz musician Gatto Barbieri, and a Keith Moon-like drummer known as Animal, who usually had a giant chain wrapped around his neck. The band was occasionally joined by a yellow afro trumpet player named Lips. The personal favorite in our house is Animal.
Of course, we have
a drummer. Our younger daughter, she went as Animal last Halloween, I think it was, maybe the Halloween before. She sat on a wagon with a mini drum kit, and we pulled her down the street.
Smart.
It was pretty cool, I gotta say. Now, among the movie musical numbers by Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem is a clever one from 1979's The Muppet Movie called Can You Picture That? Watching them perform there and elsewhere, you realize that Henson's puppeteers, this is what was so wonderful about them, they always seemed determined to create a high degree of difficulty for themselves. They didn't just envision, here's a scene we could do with puppets. It was, let's make this really tough and see if we can pull it off. It's hard enough getting puppets to just stand there and interact, but with Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem, they have to pull off the complicated coordination of creating this convincing puppet band playing together. And you know what? They do it.
They do indeed. My number four pick, probably not much in common with the Muppet Band other than the colors. There are plenty of colors in this group and their costumes as well. We're going to move up from the 60s to the 70s and go across the pond. So different than my number five pick, Eddie and the Cruisers, but actually using the same conceit. The band is Brian Slade and Venus and Furs from the Todd Haynes movie, Velvet Goldmine. And this movie, too, is based around a journalist writing a story about a character who's disappeared from public life, that character being Brian Slade, played by Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. Christian Bale is the journalist in this case. And it is very clearly a fictional band, but based on real life, because there's no doubt that Brian Slade is meant to be a stand-in for David Bowie. His Maxwell Demon persona is very clearly a reference to Ziggy Stardust. The relationship he has with Iggy Pop is mirrored in the relationship he has with an American rocker in this film called Kurt Wilde, who's played by Ewan McGregor and really does nail the Iggy Pop physicality on stage. And the movie just gets this music so right. I mean, not only are they playing a lot of those songs that perfectly coincide with the time and these artists, but there are original songs produced as well. And it helps when the English musicians in this film who were playing this music featured in these bands are Radiohead's Tom York, Johnny Greenwood, David Gray, Roxy Music's Andy McKay. On the American side, the band Wild Rats, that's Kurt Wilde's band. You've got members of the Stooges, Sonic Youth, the Minutemen, Mudhoney. So there's some real verisimilitudes certainly here in this movie with the music and how it's portrayed on screen. And I love Haynes' admiration for this music and also how it brings about this change in the Christian Bale character as we flash back on his life. There's a great scene where he's playing the music of Brian Slade. He puts that album down, Maxwell Demon. You hear that song, The Ballad of Maxwell Demon. And then as he has to sneak out of the house wearing the clothes that his parents want him to wear, and then he can take those off when he gets outside the door and be the character that he wants to be the persona he wants to be, who is someone a lot closer to Brian Slade. So I do love the music, especially in Velvet Goldmine. It's a movie I haven't seen in ages, and it's probably worth a revisit. Well, my starship doesn't want me.
Both of your picks I have not seen.
Really?
Actually, though I feel much worse about having not seen Velvet Goldmine.
Fair enough.
Compared to Eddie and the Cruisers, sorry.
Okay.
My number three pick, I hadn't even known the name of the band until I started putting together this list. It's Sweet Sue and Her Society Syncopators, the all-female band. Yeah. I can see the look on your face that you hadn't
I know where you're going.
Heard of it either, but this is the all-female band
yeah,
from
Billy Wilder.
Some Like It Hot.
Okay.
You got it. Now, I have to give credit for this one to Jeff Carpenter, a former English teacher of mine who suggested this on Facebook. Speaking of Dead Poets recently, here's another English teacher coming through. You're right. It is the Billy Wilder classic from 1959 with Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon joining in drag this band. Mostly the band is a gag, a way to get Curtis and Lemon in those dresses. They play musicians who are on the run from the mob after having witnessed the St. Valentine's Day massacre. But there's this great scene of the band rehearsing Runnin' Wild while on the train on the way to their next gig.
you two. What was your last job, playing square dances?
No, funerals.
Well, would you mind rejoining the living? Go sit up a little.
We'll try.
You really get some wonderful comedy in it because Curtis and Lemon, they're trying to fit in both as women and as musicians. And it kind of goes back and forth which one they're more inept at, mm-hmm. depending on what's happening. And of course, the scene also offers Marilyn Monroe, whose Sugarcane Kowalczyk closes out the song on her ukulele.
Running wild, lost control. Running wild, mighty bold. Feeling gay, reckless too. Carefree mind all the time, never blue. Always going, don't know where.
So Sweet Sue and her syncopators, my number three pick from Some Like It Hot.
Love it. I don't know how I'm going to top that with my number three, though. This is a film certainly far more underseen than Some Like It Hot. It's not Fade Away, and the band is The Twilight Zones. This is a movie that just came out a couple of years ago around Christmas time. David Chase from The Sopranos, this is his feature film debut as a director, and is autobiographical, another movie like it in The Cruiser set back in the 60s and in Jersey, Josh. So I should have just tried to construct a whole top five off of 60s New Jersey music movies, but he did back in his college years perform a lot, was in a band, had musical aspirations, and obviously they didn't amount to much. And that's similar with this band. The Twilight Zones don't make it very far, though they do put up a good fight. The title, Not Fade Away, I know it as a Buddy Holly song because I'm a big Buddy Holly fan, but it was repopularized by the Rolling Stones in 1964, and the Rolling Stones' influence on this movie is huge here. It has a big influence on the main character, Doug. His dad is played by James Gandolfini. Great performance, as expected from Gandolfini. And Doug gets into a band here for the same reason most guys do, which is girls, to try and impress girls, and it works for the most part. But one of the things I really appreciated about this film, which is a weird little movie, actually, is the way Chase combines together all these elements in this coming-of-age tale so that you get things that are momentous, like the sexual revolution, Vietnam, Martin Luther King's assassination, JFK's assassination, all mixed together with the Rolling Stones forming, with I Want to Hold Your Hand on Ed Sullivan, on Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. These are all part of this cultural stew, and they all matter. They all have relevance. And actually, I was looking back at my notes, I made the observation that he's making a similar point, I think, to Richard Linklater in Boyhood, where it's really about how these seemingly significant occasions are really no different than the most mundane moments. And it opens with a great bit, Josh, where a young Keith Richards meets a young Mick Jagger on a train. And it's the moment where they realize they both have an interest in blues. And, well, that's the moment that made the Rolling Stones mm-hmm. and changed popular culture, right? So it's this notion that just these little tiny experiences can have that big of an impact, and that's what the movie really explores. Matt Singer, in that Dissolve piece on fictional bands, picked The Twilight Zones as his favorite, and he said their aspirations greatly exceed their talent, and their struggles to get discovered stand in for those of the thousands upon thousands of similar bands who never made it to the big time and whose stories are rarely told on screen. The other thing they have going for them is the fact that their music was written by Steven Van Zandt, who cared enough about Not Fade Away's authenticity to put stars John Majerro and John Huston through a rock and roll boot camp so that they could credibly sing and play their own instruments on screen, which makes Not Fade Away the rare fiction movie with a genuine flavor of a concert doc. Matt's right. They look like they're pulling it off, which, as I said earlier, is really important to me. And the moment where we see them play their song, the song they hope is going to make them stars, it's called The St. Valentine's Day Massacre. It's a really good song. It's not good enough to make them into the Rolling Stones, but it's good enough to keep them struggling along as a band that thinks they just might have a shot, which is the curse of having a song that's just that good.
Well, this might be the first top five we've done where I have not seen a single film of yours so far.
My number two, I think I'm going to get you with that one too.
Oh boy. All right, we'll see. My number two is Mitch and Mickey from A Mighty Wind. This is Spinal Tap, is deserving of having this list named after it, yes, but not far behind for me is Christopher Guest's other musical mock documentary about a memorial concert that brings together a bunch of has-been folk acts. Among them is Mitch and Mickey, a once-married duo who later divorced, and they've been estranged for years. They're played by Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara. Now, Guest's films even the earlier ones, it's a little harder to sense in them, but even the earlier ones, I think, do have an affection for the characters they're often spoofing. But I feel like Mitch and Mickey are among the most poignant of any
of them.
Without
a doubt.
They're still very funny, too, though. It's not that it's made this complete switch to another tone. They just get that balance really well. One of Mitch and Mickey's famous songs was A Kiss at the End of the Rainbow, at the end of which they would share a kiss. So a big part of the suspense for this reunion concert is how that will go.
Your kiss, there's a kiss at the end of the rainbow.
A Kiss at the End of the Rainbow was written by guest regular Michael McKean and his wife, Annette O'Toole, and it was nominated for a Best Original Song Oscar. So it really works, I think, on its own terms.
Yeah.
There's some spoofing going on there, too, about that style of music, but similar to Inside Llewyn Davis, there's also a sincerity to it.
Well, the songs that Inside Llewyn Davis is making fun of are the same songs that A Mighty Wind is making fun of.
Yes, that's
in terms
a good way
of
to put it. Yeah.
Kind of the early days of folk music.
Yeah, and that
the
earnestness.
The ones
that
Llewyn Davis hates anyway.
Right.
The character.
Right, that
yeah.
he would say are inauthentic.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? It works for me. It is beautifully performed by Levy and O'Hara, for sure. And they do manage that fine line between spoofery and sincerity that the entire film really, I think, has.
I'm shocked. I always had you pegged as more of a New Main Street Singers kind of guy.
They're pretty good, too.
I guess I don't know you very well.
If you got to pick Mitch and Mickey.
Well, you almost got me with this one, but I watched A Mighty Wind for the first time last night.
Oh, you hadn't
seen it? In preparation for the list. I'd never seen it, even though I had seen all of Guest's other movies. And, of course, being someone who's into music and who plays instruments, I don't have a good explanation for why I never sought this one out. I had seen bits, like the performance at the end, but I did kind of love it.
Yeah.
It's really good. And the big reason why, you nailed it, that Mitch and Mickey performance, the whole movie hinges on it. I mean, it's setting up from the very beginning. Is Mitch even going to play? And once he does, is he going to be the old Mitch? And are we going to get that kiss? And that moment has to work. And it really, really delivers. But there's some great stuff even after that where it really hit me harder when we see them looking back on the night and they each have varying takes on what that kiss meant.
Because they go separate ways.
They do. Yeah. And their takes on that really, really hit me, actually. And I'm not used to having any kind of genuine emotional reaction to a Christopher Guest movie. And I like his movies, and I don't think they're as patronizing as a lot of people do when they write him off. I hated For Your Consideration. I don't feel
that
way about the other movies. But to watch a Christopher Guest movie that has that humor and sure is still mocking in really playful ways, but then have this undercurrent of emotion and just genuine sympathy and empathy for its characters, it really surprised me, actually.
No, you're right. I think that level of motion is the next step that it takes, even beyond Waiting for Guffman, which you I felt a little bit, but here, it's full force.
All right, Josh, do you know a little film from 1982 called Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains?
No.
All right, I'm 4-for-4.
Wow.
I'm going with The Fabulous Stains, but you can also throw in their sometimes opening act / headlining act, The Looters, as well, because they're pretty fantastic. And this is a Lou Adler movie. He also produced The Rocky Horror Picture Show. And I had never even heard of this movie before hearing Laura Dern's interview on WTF with Marc Maron a few months ago. It was her fourth movie, but her first adult role. She's all of 14 or 15, if you can call that being an adult. And in the movie, she plays the cousin of Diane Lane, who's the main character of the movie. She's a character named Corinne Burns, and she is the lead singer in The Stains. Her sister plays guitar. Her cousin, played by Laura Dern, as I mentioned, is the bass player. And they're a punk band. Their mother has died of cancer. They have nothing. They have a very cynical take on the world. And they happen to get a chance to go out on the road with this touring band, even though they basically only know one song. This really is a cult movie that deserves to be more widely seen. It's a satire of the music business and the media, with Lane really slyly manipulating television to her advantage to get promotion until it does turn against her. It's a movie about the dangers of conformity, and it's also, Josh, a movie very much about feminism and the struggle to assert your identity in a male-dominated world. Corinne's got this mantra that is, "I don't put out. We're the Stains and we don't put out." And there's an obvious sexual connotation to that, but they're also expressing this idea that they're not going to be taken advantage of. They're not going to be what you want them to be and fit into your tidy notions of womanhood. Their best song and they really only have one other song, is a song they steal from the Looters. They perform it at a mall, and it's called Join the Professionals. And this is a song written, obviously, from a male perspective. It references the army. You get lines like, yeah, I want to see the world for free, but I won't like the things I see. Up 2-3-4 really ain't my style. It takes on a completely different meaning when sung from a female perspective, and that scene in a mall where they perform it is really good stuff. I mentioned Lou Adler produced the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and this movie does have that borderline camp feel to it at times. It's silly, it's cheaply made for sure, but as I said, I think it's really smart in the way it tackles some legitimate issues, and there's a real knockout scene with a very young Christine Lottie as Laura Dern's mother, the aunt to Diane Lane. And she goes on TV and the media says, was your daughter always this much of a troublemaker? And her reaction is to say, well, yeah, she was. She's always been a nightmare. And then she catches herself and she delivers this really genuinely touching soliloquy where she reflects on the fact that her parents treated her the same way she treated her daughter and how proud she is actually to see those girls up on stage. It's a great scene. And Diane Lane, man, is so good here. One of her early performances, this perfect mixture of hurt, scared little kid and too smart for her own age, rebelliousness. I've said too much, but I do have to mention the Looters, that band, the punk band, the Sex Pistols-inspired band that she goes on the road with. Ray Winstone. Did you know, Josh, that there was a time where he was a young man?
I just thought he arrived fully formed.
I know, me too, right? Like the sexy beast Ray Winstone, yes, is right. The only Ray Winstone that's ever been in existence. No, he was really young once and pretty gorgeous too. And he's Billy, the lead singer of this punk band. He's a charismatic presence. I'm not sure if he's really doing the singing or not, but he certainly has the sneer and the fierce conviction of a punk band. And the band, of course, sounds like the real deal and not a fake movie band because their drummer and guitarist are Steve Jones and Paul Cook from the Sex Pistols. Their bass player is Paul Simonon from The Clash. And that song I mentioned, Join the Professionals, was actually a song those guys wrote in one of their post-Sex Pistols groups. So very authentic playing here and a really smart cult movie that, as I said, I hope more people see.
Well, I'm prioritizing your picks here in order of what I should see. So Velvet Goldmine,
yeah,
is the first one. And then Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains. Not Fade Away after that. I don't know if I'll ever have time for any
Man,
of the Cruisers.
I'm going to work
Sorry.
On you. I'm going to work on you. I'm going to get on the dark side on your iPod.
That's after Roadhouse.
Fair.
All right, number one. It's the Soggy Bottom Boys from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
In constant sorrow.
We talked about how these have to be fictional bands, and the Soggy Bottom Boys are fake in two senses. They only exist in the movie, of course, and they aren't even really a band in the movie. Instead, in the Coen Brothers 2000 farce, which is set in the American South of the 1930s, this is one of the covers that is used by the movie's three escaped convicts, George Clooney, John Turturro, and Tim Blake Nelson, while they're on the run. Now, although they're a fake band, they run into a radio station to perform a song to earn some money, they do manage to record a real hit, Man of Constant Sorrow, which became something of a real-world hit of its own for the best-selling Oh Brother soundtrack. I do love this whole soundtrack, probably because a lot of these blues gospel songs are familiar from my childhood. You have You Are My Sunshine, I'll Fly Away. Now, full credit should be given, of course, to the people behind the music. You said you want to be able to believe that the actors are singing this. I don't think anyone believes George Clooney when he belts out
no.
Man of Constant Sorrow. T-Bone Burnett was the producer, and on Man of Constant Sorrow, the voices belong to Dan Tominski, Harley Allen, and Pat Enright. In one sense, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is one of the flimsiest Coen Brothers films. At least, let's say it's one of the most pastiche-iest. I mean, it's inspired by a lot of bits they're throwing into the mix here. But often I think in their movies, the meat of the matter is in what's going on in the corners or in the details. So in a way, you could argue that this collection of songs, which are about suffering and perseverance, about doubt and belief, that's probably what Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is really about. So Soggy Bottom Boys, my number one movie band.
And that song became kind of a hit for a while, didn't it? I mean, it was everywhere. And I've lamented before, unfortunately, that that's one of the few Coen Brothers movies. I like their work so much. I don't get to rewatch a lot of movies, but I've seen most of their stuff more than once. That's one I've only seen once when it came out in the theater, didn't write about it, didn't talk about it. And when people write in and say, how did you leave it off this top five list and that top five list? I always regret that I haven't seen it again because people love it. Yeah, most of our listeners who write in love it.
I've probably only seen it once and would like to revisit it as well. You know, in their filmography, I don't rank it as high as a lot of their stuff, but I still do appreciate it quite a bit, and the music is probably the main reason.
Hmm. My number one, I know you have seen, Josh. I've got three words for you. Yeah. Origin of Love.
Oh, that's a good song.
I've got five more words for you. Hedwig and the Angry Inch. I mentioned Origin of Love because that song is so good in this 2001 film from director and star John Cameron Mitchell, but there may be nothing better actually than the opening credit sequence, the spectacle of Hedwig performing Tear Me Down at a Bilge Waters in Kansas City while old people immediately scatter for the door.
Don't you know me, Kansas City? I'm the new Berlin Wall. Try to tear me down. I was born on the other side of a town ripped in two. I made it over the great divide. Now I'm coming for you. Enemies and adversaries, they try and tear me down. You want me, baby, I dare you. But try and tear me down.
I love that opening. And for those of you who are familiar with Hedwig, this is a character who has a botched sex change and starts a band and is a transgender figure, obviously, and develops a relationship with a younger man, Tommy, played by Michael Pitt, who ends up stealing her songs and running off and becoming a big star. The one problem was seeing Hedwig, and I hadn't seen it since 2001, but I was rewatching clips to get ready for this list. And the bad part is then you end up going to, say, the gym, or you go to the supermarket and you find yourself out loud singing things like 6 inches forward, 5 inches back, I got an angry inch. People look at you funny, Josh.
Yeah,
they do.
They probably don't know what you're talking about at the supermarket.
No. And because I haven't seen it in so long, and I know you just caught up with it, I'm actually a little bit more curious to get your reaction than for me to babble about it.
No, it was brilliant. And the music is a big part of that. And the Bilgewater scenes. I mean, it's sort of like a Denny's, right? It's this middle brow restaurant, or maybe it's the equivalent of Pizza Ranch. I can picture,
how dare you?
I can picture Hedwig playing at a lot of Iowa pizza ranches. But you're right. The reaction of her performance and the disparity between that and the intensity and the commitment to what it is and the people in the audience, the so-called audience,
right,
is just so great. But I think Mitchell's performance in those scenes, it's at once wanting to be so entertaining for those people and wanting this to be such a good time with the costumes and the wigs and the music itself and the calisthenics of the act. Yet what he's singing about is just some wrecking stuff,
mm-hmm,
you know, that she's gone through in her transformation, in her life, when you do pay attention to those lyrics. And there's just a really bittersweet dichotomy between the performance and the subject matter that does carry through in the whole film.
Yeah, you nailed it. It's the John Cameron Mitchell performance. It's the music, the intensity and the emotion of it, and the subtext and the text of it. The humor and the heartbreak mixed in those songs really is something that makes Hedwig and the Angry Inch special. And it's my number one fictional movie band. And those are our top five fictional movie bands. Josh, what about any honorable mentions?
Hedwig is probably my number six. You encouraged me to watch it, so I knew it was going to be on your list. They have the best band name for sure, I think, of any of these that we've talked about. Also, in real competition for this list was Sex Bomb from Scott Pilgrim.
Another great name
in the world. Yes, it is a great name.
Though not as good even as The Clash at Demonhead, also in Scott Pilgrim.
That's true.
That's an even better band.
Another one that couldn't make my list because really I'd be mentioning Back to the Future pretty much for any top five list I would like to, but Marvin Berry and the Starlighters. And then the John Glenn Singers. I thought an inside Llewyn Davis group might make your list. Though I know you like Llewyn Davis
best.
That's
the problem.
I mean,
yeah.
he's the artistically
he's the true
one that you want to align with.
Yeah.
But the John Glenn Singers, that novelty trio behind A Please Mr. Kennedy, it's Oscar Isaac, Justin Timberlake, and Adam Driver, I gave them some consideration too.
Yeah, I could see that. That's a great choice. I also considered the Blues Brothers, Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem from The Muppets, and Sex Bomb. But Mitch and Mickey came really close to making my list from A Mighty Wind. Others that neither of us have mentioned, but were definitely in contention. The Ruddles, the Eric Idle band, the Beatles ripoff.
See,
it's a funny show.
See, why didn't you pick that? And then I would have been...
Five for five. I should have gone with the Ruddles. Maybe it's just been too long. You know, there was a show a while back where I made a reference to Chase Stadium, the stadium built after the famous revolutionary Chase Stadium, which is a line from the Ruddles. And Josh, not one person on Twitter or email wrote in to tell me I was a hero.
It just died. Well, can the Ruddles, I mean, does it sustain itself? My suspicion with that movie is,
I remember thinking it was hilarious.
Joke really sustain itself?
I was going through a real Beatles phase at the time. I don't know what to call the band. They eventually became the Swell Season, but in the movie they were just guy and girl, mm-hmm. Markita Irglova and Glenn Hansard. That was hard to leave off the Falling Slowly sequence. The Broken Circle Breakdown, the Belgian film that we recently talked about. Whatever that music is they're playing, this mixture of Americana, it's bluegrass.
It's
really good. I enjoyed the music in that film quite a bit. And the Alan Parker movie, The Commitments. I love the music in The Commitments as well. Those are, again, our top five movie bands. We want to know what you think. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and @Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, As Above, So Below. It's a thriller, Josh. It at least wants to be a thriller. We don't know if it is. Archaeologists searching for lost treasure below Paris.
Sounds thrilling. It sounds like something Nicolas Cage should be in.
I know,
maybe.
It does. Out in limited release opening here in Chicago, To Be To K. This is the documentary about the actor and activist. Also out, Jealousy from French director Philippe Garrel. This is playing at the Jean Siskel Film Center. I am very embarrassed to admit that I haven't seen a single film from Philippe Garrel, the French director, though I have seen films directed by and starring his son, Louis Garrel. He's in The Dreamers and Dom Perry with Romain Duris.
And, you know, in fairness, you have seen Eddie and the Cruisers 100 times.
100 times. And that has to count for something, Josh. At the Music Box, the 6th Annual Noir Movie Fest, It's a Bitter Little World, that obviously sounds like it's worth checking out. Also, Love is Strange. This is Alfred Molina and John Lithgow as a longtime couple who finally marry, only to have some financial troubles that keep them apart. It's from director Ira Sachs, who made Keep the Lights On, a very good movie. And we do have to highlight Frank, the new music movie starring Michael Fassbender.
Highly recommend.
It is. Next week on the show, we are planning to do our fall movie preview because, yes, it does seem that summer is already over. And we're going to not only talk about movies, but maybe some performances or anything that's happening around the fall movie season that just has us really intrigued and curious.
Are we cutting that off at like Thanksgiving, or are we going through the end of the year?
Thanksgiving.
Okay.
We're doing the November cutoff there. We're also going to do our end of summer movie roundup. There's been a bunch of movies that we've kind of been seeing on our own, but haven't been able to fit in for full discussions, like The Trip to Italy, The One I Love. We might catch up with The Congress from Ari Folman. Polanski's got a new film out, Venus and Fur, that's playing on demand. So there's at least three movies probably in the mix that we're going to just spend a few minutes each on next week on the show.
And I think the majority of these are on demand, right? So
that's
listeners
right.
could
so you can,
pick and choose, watch one or two along with us.
That's right. And we are hoping as well to talk to director Dan Schechter. He is the writer and director of the latest Elmore Leonard adaptation called Life of Crime. It's got Tim Robbins, John Hawks, Jennifer Aniston, Isla Fisher. And Dan Schechter also happens to be a longtime Film Spotting listener. So really interested in hearing his story, Josh, and how he went from a guy in 2008 who was submitting his movies to Slam Dance to now directing Elmore Leonard adaptations with that cast. So hoping to have him on next week as well.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and to the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.